Hello, hello. It is May.
It is. And we have 99,800 subscribers on YouTube now. And of those, one is currently watching this show.
Hey. 200 more before we hit the 100K.
Yeah, major props to Damien on that one. He Absolutely. Has built it since, I believe, 20,000, maybe 25,000. And it's been a couple of years, a few years, maybe. Not 100% sure. But yeah, it's been a long time coming. We're finally going to hit that milestone.
Definitely.
And yeah, I can't think of a good segue here, but speaking of milestones, Google has finally, and I don't say finally lightly, I'm kind of strict about using that word too much. Finally has rolled out the transfer tool for transferring over Google Play Music libraries over to YouTube Music.
Yes, this is a long time coming. So as a brief history, the new YouTube Music relaunched in 2018. And this was when everybody was talking about what Google was going to do in music. All the rumors about their new streaming service, their new unified streaming service, and it ended up being the YouTube Music app just redesigned completely. And over the past 2 years, Google has been working on new features. But the one that Play Music diehards have been waiting for, as you mentioned, is the migration tool. I think Google originally promised it within a year or something like that. And they, of course, didn't meet that deadline. Did you ever use Play Music, or were you a Spotify the instant it came to the United States?
Back in the early days of streaming services, I bounced around between a few. For a while, actually, I was sticking with Pandora and just listening to it.
Memories.
And then I jumped around. I think I was on Spotify for a while before I got into Android phones. I was using it on my desktop, and that was probably even, it might have been before Spotify had mobile apps at all.
Oh, wow.
I was a pretty early adopter of Spotify. I think within a month of it launching in the US, I'm pretty sure it was desktop only, and I was already on it. That was back when Spotify, I don't know, this is a little bit inside, but Spotify was actually, it may still be, but it was peer-to-peer at one point. I don't think it is anymore. But early on, it was actually peer-to-peer, meaning, you know, it functionally at a technological level worked similarly to LimeWire or other, you know, like those kind of illegal piracy services or applications. But anyways, I was on Spotify for a while, but then I started to get into Android phones. And like I said, this may have been, I don't remember, I don't have perfect memory on this, but it may have been before Spotify even had its mobile applications. And I tried out Google Music and Google Play Music. And I think for about a year or two, I used Google Play Music as my primary streaming service. I bought some music on there. I bought some movies on there. I kind of was living in, this is around Nexus 5, you know, timeline. somewhere in there. Shamu time.
Shamu.
Nexus 6. Somewhere in there, I was actually all in. I was all in on Google everything. I was using a Nexus phone as my primary daily driver, and I was in all the Google Play services, including Play Music. And I think after a while, I think Spotify just got to a point where it just was, in terms of feature set and ability to use it cross-platform and everything. I think Spotify just eventually won me out, and I slowly just faded away from Google Play Music. And I just had to start over when I did that. And so, since then, I've been on Spotify.
So my brief history has been, yes, I used Pandora very briefly before I got really into audio. Remember audio?
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Google Play Music. I did use Spotify. I had that free 3-month trial of Spotify when it came to the US. I remember snagging one of those invites. But after that, yeah, I went to Play Music because I was one of those people that bought music and uploaded songs to Play Music. I liked managing files, basically, from iTunes then to Play Music when I wanted it in the cloud. So that I used it all the way to when YouTube Music relaunched in 2018. I waited like a month or two before jumping over to YouTube Music, but since then I've been into YouTube Music, and I would say that my behavior, my music listening behavior, has totally changed because of YouTube Music, and that for the longest while I was annoyed that I didn't have my files, the albums that I added to my library that I liked, that kind of stuff from Play Music. And there was definitely a period where I used both services. But over time, like, YouTube Music converted me to the streaming model, as in terms of I don't really collect music anymore as much as I just search for what I want to listen and trust the algorithm recommendations that are surfaced and a big part of YouTube Music. So that really was a transition. And I have to say, I think that's what Google wants most users to be, to just be, they want to track the YouTube-centric crowd where they listen to just free stuff on YouTube. And that's the audience. But at the same time, they have this huge legacy of people they need to bring over, people who are paying for the service, who have paid for all access, for all that, and they need to keep them on YouTube, on a Google service. And that is the big part of this transition this week.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, I mean, I never really had that issue. I never was a music collector. I mean, I did have my own, I just like anyone, I had an iTunes library, you know, I had an iPod. And so I had, you know, maybe a few $100 worth of music that I had bought track by track on iTunes. But I was young enough that I didn't have, when all of that was happening, I was young enough that I didn't really have much of a substantial library. Mm-hmm. And so that was never even a concern of mine. And so it made it really easy for me to switch over to Spotify early on. And I know a lot of people, even to this day, have been hardcore, you know, diehards on Play Music because of that music library cloud feature, which, if you don't use Play Music and now YouTube Music, the only service, I mean, off the top of my head that makes that really easy is Plex. But I think Plex is the only one that I can think of that makes it pretty easy to host. And but even Plex is even Plex is hosted on your own server. It's not.
Can you name the Apple's version of this? There is a name for it.
iTunes Match.
Yes, iTunes Match.
Is that still a thing? I think they deprecated that after. I thought they deprecated that after Apple Music launched, but
I think iTunes in the cloud is still there, and it's along with. I'm pretty sure it's still there.
Okay,
you have to pay.
I believe you.
However much. Amazon also had the service, but they killed it a few years back, leaving Google and Apple there.
Yeah.
iCloud Music Library. Wow, that is a while. But yeah, iTunes Match. So it's really, it's people are limited with the services, and Google's is to their credit, is entirely free. That you have to pay an annual subscription for iTunes Match.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Apple was initially pretty resistant to the whole streaming model for a good reason, because it had a pretty significant business model that was going pretty well for them, collecting royalties on 99-cent track downloads.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the other side of this for a lot of people was podcasts. And a lot of people, I don't know that many people that use Google Play Music as their primary podcast platform. I think I've looked at our stats briefly, and even us, which of all podcasts that are out on the web, we should be the one that has a significant listening on Play Music. If there is any podcast that people listen to on Play Music, this would be the one. And it doesn't seem like the numbers are really substantial. So I don't think there's really that many people other than those just diehard users that have just stuck with Play Music for the longest time. And it seems like this whole transitionary period for Google, like you said, is Google just retaining that minority of diehards that have stuck with Play Music this whole time for all of their listening needs. And, you know, it's probably, in the grand scheme of things, in terms of how many subscribers YouTube Music will have, I think that the people that will be transitioning over from Play Music will probably be relatively small.
I do feel that too. It took Google a while to get there. And if there are I feel like so many YouTube Music users are there because of YouTube Premium, because of the ability to not have to see ads on YouTube. That's just a natural thing that Google's offering. And the real pitch, well, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter why you're paying Google. You have a 99 for premium. As long as you're there, I don't think Google really minds. But at the same time, they do want to build out this music, their music offering. And they are doing a lot of stuff to appeal to new people, redesigns, the latest discovery features are there. Just as of last week, they just rolled out a new Now Playing and Explore tab. That's brand new. But in terms of bringing over the Play Music users, when they expanded playlist from 1,000 to 5,000, how many songs you can have in the playlist, and they gave everybody the ability to upload 100,000 songs instead of 50,000. So they're doing all these things, like by the nature of never updating Play Music back for the past 2 years, you are getting a much nicer looking app. But I see a disparity in what the service that old Play Music users want to use and what the future of music streaming is, so to speak.
Yeah. I just feel like the whole reason behind this is doesn't really have to do with user wants or desires. I think it mostly has to do with just how brands have been naturally picked up culturally. I mean, if you pick any of your favorite artists and go on their Instagram page and click on one of their, you know, like featured highlight stories, that's the kind of thing that's really informing these decisions, I think, because when you click on these and you see what these artists are how they're promoting their music. They're promoting their music to how their fans are listening to their music. And right now, because of Google's really confusing mess of branding and disorganized development, that's just the curse of Google, right? Because of that, all these artists are not telling their fans, like, you will not, I guarantee you, in 2020, even 2019, maybe even 2018, you will not go on one of these artists' Instagram profiles and see them say, listen to my music over on Google Play Music, because that's just not where people are. I mean, it's like, I think we have to keep in context that Google Play Music has been in some ways kind of a a disappointment in terms of actual usage and traction. When you put it in comparison to Spotify and now Apple Music, obviously Apple Music was able to just jump onto the scene out of nowhere and dominate a huge user base because, you know, Apple has antitrust advantages and a monopoly on the entire smartphone ecosystem from pretty much. But, you know, even now you see how artists are promoting and where their fans are actually listening. It's always Spotify and Apple Music. And the third totem pole that you will see sometimes, because it's such a huge platform, one of the biggest media platforms on the internet is YouTube. And so Google had to meet people where they were. Instead of trying to brute force the Play Music brand and service into the music industry, they said, well, we own this service that is already successful. We own this brand that is already extremely well-known and successful and is widely associated with all kinds of media consumption. And so how do we leverage that advantage that we already had? And that's how YouTube Music came into existence. I don't think it really has anything to do with Google Play Music. It really is just Google recognizing, as they always do, okay, they did an A-B test here. And the A-B test was, you can listen to music on Google Play Music, or you can listen to music in the form of a video on YouTube that plays in the background. Which of those two is going to win? And over the course of the last 5 to 10 years, we found out which one won. And YouTube won. And so now they're taking the winner and they're morphing it into something that more reflects the original intention of the service that they rolled out with Play Music. Mm-hmm. And I think those people that are already consuming a crap ton of music on YouTube, those are going to be the people that are going to find themselves subscribing to YouTube Music. And honestly, in terms of sheer raw numbers, the number of people that are going to be transferring over from Google Play Music is going to be small. So this is really good for those people that are fans of Google, that are listening to this podcast, that read 9to5 Google, because those are the people that would be in that minority, right? But yeah, I think that's just how I've been thinking about this. It's great news, but we have to remember that YouTube Music is, I think a lot of people in our little bubble underestimate how successful YouTube Music will be, because from our bubble's perspective, it has been shoddy and kind of lackluster in comparison to what we liked about Play Music. And it's taken forever for Google to build out these features. But I think in the long run, the extreme mass of users, they're going to be able to pull into YouTube Music from something that's already successful, that people already associate with media, is going to be way more than Google ever had in terms of install base on Play Music.
Definitely. To put a capper on this discussion, what Google said on Tuesday is that Play Music is coming. You will no longer be able to access Play Music later this year. They didn't give a hard date. And one thing I do want to point out is that Google this week did not discuss what is happening with buying purchases from the Play Store, about the ability to buy songs and albums from the Play Store. Because right now, even with this new transfer tool, if you're still buying something from Play Music, it will only appear in Google Play Music like before. If you want to get into YouTube Music, you'll have to initiate a new transfer again. And honestly, I don't think that bodes well for the continued ability to buy an album or buy a song in a way that something like Spotify doesn't have it. Of course, Apple Music has that feature. They still have the legacy iTunes store. But discussion...
We don't know how long the life on that is going to be.
Absolutely. There's perpetual discussion about that shutting down every so often. So the age of being able to buy music files, I think that might be sunsetting. Again, Google hasn't confirmed this yet. We'll know more about what happens with that aspect later this year when Google shares its transition plans, its final deprecation plans, rather, with About Play Music.
Yep. In terms of other Google services, we could talk real quick about Nest Aware, which got a revamp this week. And Nest Aware is a really old service that Nest has been offering since before it was even owned by Google, I'm pretty sure. I'm not 100% on that, but sounds right. And it's basically been used for the most part, most people associate it with being able to have expanded storage and access to video files on your Nest Cam. And I guess in addition to that, it's added some other kind of just slightly more smart features and alerts and notifications to other Nest products. And Google is revamping it now.
I think in a way, this is another small finally, because this is the last product announced and made by Google 2019 in October that hasn't launched yet. And they said it was coming early 2020, but we're in May now, and I think that's officially lapsed. So yeah, new Nestware, new pricing model, fixed pricing model for up to 10 devices. It's no longer a per device thing, so it's much cheaper, and you can pay yearly and all that good stuff.
And Nest Hub is $90 now instead of $130.
Yes, $89.99. They added a 99 cents to it from being $129. I think the notable thing about that is it is priced exactly like the Echo Show 8 now, right now. And that's the state of it.
Yep. Well, let's transition now into the part of the show that everyone's probably interested in. And spoiler alert, we have a little bit of a detail for you here in a couple minutes. But first, I want to talk about some stuff that happened this week with a report that came out of The Information. And really what this report highlighted, in essence, it caused a little bit of a stir, because I think the angle was kind of like, oh, Pixel 4 was a flop and here's all the internal drama. And that's true, and it probably is absolutely true that there is some internal drama regarding the Pixel 4's lackluster sales, which, by the way, we detailed in a report a few weeks back. We actually dug into the statistics of 9to5 Google's traffic and actually pulled together the estimates for how many people reading 9to5 Google are using Pixel 3s versus Pixel 4s and Pixel 2s. And it seemed to back up the rumored or guess estimated sales numbers for the Pixel 4 that it just hasn't sold as well as Google would have hoped for a lot of different reasons. And this report out of The Information this week detailed some things happening inside, the first of which being Mark Lavoie, who has been the camera guy since the beginning of the Pixel. He has departed Google. And it seems like that was just, it was never really formally announced. I'm sure Google probably did not want to make any fanfare of that. apparently Mark just updated his LinkedIn profile. Is that correct?
Yes. To say that he left in March, he was officially a distinguished engineer at the company. Since 2014, it's a notable run, in addition to being a Stanford professor, I believe.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that a lot of the angle that people are going with this is, you know, oh, well, the Pixel camera is the most important feature of the Pixel, and Google just lost the camera guy, and therefore the Pixel is doomed. Is that kind of the
yeah, there is
what you're getting?
Yeah, there is that worry that on from the users, from the fan level, there is this worry that the guy responsible for HDR plus, portrait mode, night sight, and this whole computational photography revolution in modern smartphones is no longer at the company. That's the scale of the worry from regular
right. people. Yeah. To me, though, I just feel like the concern around his departure is kind of overblown. To me, this feels more like a natural departure. It feels like, I mean, 6 years is probably about average for a professional at his level staying at a company. And it feels like he came to Google with an opportunity and a goal in mind, and there was probably from the beginning some kind of finish line for achieving that goal. And I think he probably came into Google saying, I want to make smartphone cameras, you know, better than they've ever been. I want it to be basically a revolution, like you said, and I want to use, you know, computational photography to do that. And to me, it feels like a natural departure in the sense that he has done that. I mean, as we've seen the Pixel grow from the first Pixel, and we were talking about this a little bit this week in Slack, where I feel like the original Pixel and its debut on the scene with its original computational photography techniques, it really busted on the scene because it was like night and day versus the current iPhone at the time, which had only been announced a month earlier, the iPhone 7. And if you compare even today, I mean, just I dare you pull out an original Pixel and compare its photography versus the iPhone 7. And it's not even close. And I think that over the last 4 years, 5 years, the Pixel's, I guess, computational photography advantages have waned for a couple reasons. One being, when you fundamentally revolutionize a technology like that, it's going to have diminishing returns, right? It's just like anything else. Like the smartphone came onto the scene, and how exciting are smartphones today? They're not. Every year, there's diminishing returns. They're more and more like the previous year every year that goes by. And so, you know, I think Mark should be proud for what he accomplished, but I think he's also recognizing, you know, there's only so much I can do here that's not going to immediately just, you know, as we're seeing the last couple of years, Apple in particular has pretty much caught up. And so my argument is that Google's computational photography stuff and its lead with the Pixel was not as much about prowess and skill, although Mark is obviously one of the most intelligent, computational photography engineers in the whole world. So there's obviously prowess in that sense. But what I'm saying is I think that the Pixel story is more about timing and Google doing it first than it is about doing something that is unique to Google. And I think that's been proven the last couple of years, especially the last year with other players. And we're kind of back to square one, right? Like in 2014, all of the cameras and on the phones were all pretty much the same. And then Google came onto the scene and really shook things up with what it was doing with computational photography and the Pixel. And now we're kind of back, you know, obviously there's still disparity. The OnePlus phone doesn't look exactly the same as the Samsung phone or the Pixel phone or the iPhone, but we're kind of getting back to that same place of, every phone has a night mode. Every phone has a portrait mode that doesn't require extra hardware. Every phone has HDR Plus. Every phone has all of these different computational photography technologies. And we're kind of, you know, back to square one and everything's pretty much the same again, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. I don't know. His departure feels like an admission of that, which I don't know if that's bad news.
The timing, I do agree with your premise that it's he's done what he's done and everybody has caught up basically, but at the same time, this timing does not help in terms of Google. The Pixel 4 was the Pixel 4, and we're still months out from the Pixel 5, whatever that happens to be. The timing did not help. And the thing that you do want to ask that I guess the more tangible worry looking at the future that most people have is what's next for the Pixel camera. What are they going to do? How are they going to get better?
I think that's the question.
What's the next software defined
leap? Yeah. I just think that's an existential question that they were facing, regardless of whether or not Mark is on the team. What do you think about Mario's departure? What's your take on that?
So Mario, he was in charge. I think a big bit of context helps it. He joined Google in 2005. He helped launch Nexus One. A few years later, from 2010 to 2016, he led Google TV, Chromecast, Wi-Fi, and Google Home, which, if you remember, he unveiled at I/O 2016. He was responsible for all that stuff. And it emerged in last August, a few months before the Pixel 4 launched. He was moved away from his position as the Pixel team's general manager. And that happened again in August. He was moved to this like nebulous role in the office of the CEO. But now it emerged that he left Google entirely in January 2020. And he's now working at this cybersecurity firm. So his departure is...
It almost feels like a retirement to me.
Almost, yeah. She's not doing hardware anymore. That's after a long career in hardware. It's quite odd to see him go into cybersecurity, as was reported this week. So yeah, his legacy there. No, he started the Pixel. He helped release the first phone, the Pixel 2, the Pixel 3. So those first three phones and basically the fourth phone was still under the Pixel 4 was still under his leadership when it happened.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about, I guess the more controversial part of this of this report, which is they quoted Rick Osterloh for a little bit of background. Rick was running Motorola and its smartphone efforts with some of the best Motorola phones that ever launched. I mean, going back to the original Moto X, kind of goes all the way back to Motorola's first stint at Google before they were loft at Google. And then Rick decided, you know, to come on in at Google and lead their hardware efforts. And that includes the Pixel phone. And the Pixel 4 was obviously one of the, I guess, most controversial of the four major flagship launches that Google's had so far. And one of the most controversial parts of that launch was the battery situation. And apparently, according to the information, I'm just going to read this. I'm just going to quote it because it seems weird to me. I don't know if I'm not 100% sure whether or not the way they frame this is what actually happened. That's what we're going to talk about here. But this is what they said. This is from the information. At a hardware team all hands meeting in the fall ahead of the October launch in New York, Osterloh informed staff about his own misgivings. He told them he did not agree with some of the decisions made about the phone. Speaking about the Pixel 4, which, by the way, the IDC estimates Google shipped around 2 million units of it, compared to 3.5 million of the Pixel 3 and nearly 3 million Pixel 3As. So those are IDC's estimates. I guess that's a little bit of color for his disgruntled opinion about the battery situation. He told them he did not agree with some of the decisions made about the phone, according to two people who were present at the meeting. In particular, he was disappointed in its battery power. Google denied a request to speak with Osterloh. So it sounds like, I mean, my initial take with this was kind of surprised that I just don't really understand how Google or how Rick himself could be frustrated with the battery situation. It sounds to me like something that would be his job to ensure is not an issue. I mean, I think obviously there's other people underneath Osterloh that run the different segments of hardware, obviously, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, the buck stops with him, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe not, because we're not seeing that in our current presidential situation. or in a lot of political situations right now. Not to get political, we just typically don't do that on this podcast. But, you know, doesn't the buck stop with Rick on something as significant as whether or not the phone holds a charge? I mean,
yeah, it's,
that's how I feel.
Leadership, it's yeah, the leadership structure, most leadership structures, they have the person in charge of the division, in charge of entire hardware efforts, would be who the buck stops with. But in this case, it makes it seem that Rick delegated a lot of power to the lieutenants, to the people under him, to the product managers under him. And
yeah,
this is him becoming aware of that. But the phrasing of this makes it seem like he wasn't aware of it until too late in the process. It's an interesting look into how Google does leadership.
Yeah. Obviously we don't have a report on this, and we're kind of just trying to piece together little details to get a vague picture. That's all we're ever really able to paint, is a vague picture of what's going on the inside. But we did have, after this report, you know, one of our tipsters kind of reached out and maybe tried to give us a little bit of color on what exactly happened with Rick. This person really, you know, reiterated that Oslo really was like mad about the battery for the Pixel 4, which to me even further reiterates the idea that he was blaming other people for the decision and gave a lot of power away. And in fact, our tipster seems to suggest that that's kind of what happened, that he actually blamed himself for making the decision to delegate so much of that power on these decisions. So, I mean, I guess, I don't know. It's like, it seems weird that Pixel 4, I mean, this was post HTC acquisition. The Pixel 4 was the first flagship that Google was supposed to come out with that, you know, was really built from the ground up. At Google, besides, I mean, the Pixel 3a was also under that umbrella, but that was not a flagship. You know, built from the ground up using that HTC bought team. How does Osterloh like miss something this big and then you know blame his reports for it? It just seems odd. But it is you know, notable that our tips are saying that he also was kind of mad at himself for doing that. So just seems like a very bitter situation all around. And our tipster now says that we can expect that Osterloh is going to be a bit more hands-on with the Pixel 5, or has been. Pixel 5 is pretty much done at this point. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's the Pixel 4 drama. Let's talk a little bit about the Pixel 4a and then we'll come back to some things we're hearing about Pixel 5. So here's the big alphabet scoop on the Pixel 4a. This is the first time that I've mentioned this anywhere. I'm about to tweet it as I say it here. But this is our little alphabet exclusive. I've heard the Pixel 4a is going to cost $349 and not $399 as was leaked. So we've seen leaks of some billboard renders that showed the Pixel 4a. Have I been saying Pixel 3a? It doesn't matter.
No, 4a, you got it.
We saw these billboards that I think Evan Evleeks was the guy who originally shared those.
Yes, billboards.
Renders that showed the Pixel 4a and showed that it would cost $399. And we've been kind of running with that assumption that that was going to be the price, because it was the intro price for the Pixel 3a as well. And then, you know, we saw some sales that brought the Pixel 3a down to $299 in some cases, some retailers. And we just assumed that things were just going to be the same situation this year. But yeah, we're hearing that it's actually going to be $349, according to one of my little birdies. And in addition to that, I'll also note, I reported back a month or so ago, another one of my sources was telling me that there might not be a 64 gig model of the Pixel 4a. And now this other source is telling me, yeah, it's almost certain that the 128 gig model is going to be that, is going to be that model that costs $349. So I'm corroborating myself in my previous reporting when I said that, it seems like Google really is trying to minimize the SKUs on Pixel 4a. If that's the case, we'll see two models, probably two different colors, 349, 120, both at 128 gigs. So that's what we're hearing about Pixel 4a.
Mm-hmm.
How does that change things with how it stacks up with the iPhone SE? Yeah, I mean, everything else.
Ultimately, it's price. If the most important thing about a phone is its price and the value, the perceived value you're getting from it. And we don't know when was this price was decided, but it is competitive. It is people in people's heads seeing those numbers, $399 versus $349. The psychology of it is it's way under $400, and it's eye catching really. And everything we've seen about this phone that's leaked shows it's going to be one heck of a deal at $349.
Yeah, and I mean that's what it feels like to me. I mean, I think when Apple launched the iPhone SE, it became really clear that Google didn't exactly have the obvious advantage that it had last year with the 3A.
Yeah.
Because there was no real competition for the 3A. It was just like the best phone at $400 by far with no real alternatives. I mean, there are obviously some mid-ranger or lower mid-range Android alternatives, but you can't compare against the software experience on the Pixel 3A and especially the camera, and the battery life was stellar. And, you know, like it was a very clear cut winner last year. And I think this year, if they had done $399 for the 64 gig model, again, it would have been tough to do side by side, you know, comparisons, in terms of value proposition. And I think dropping it down to $349 for the 128 gig model is going to give it this narrative, I think, amongst the Android crowd of being a pretty darn good value. And if that's what Google wants to do with the Pixel, with the A series, I think they're gonna win. So that's Pixel 4a.
Yeah. That's hilarious. That's funny. But yeah, so it obviously hasn't launched yet. This week was supposed to be IO week before the world happened. There's this from a German carrier, Vodafone in Germany. According to their internal database, they originally had a May 22nd availability date a few weeks earlier, but it's since been moved to June 3rd, excuse me. And that's to June 5th, actually. In terms of timing, that's 2 days after Google is having its Android 11 beta launch show. So I don't know how that thematically works. Your Google is announcing the beta for Android 11, and then here's this phone running Android 10. I'm not sure how thematically linked those two will be, but in terms of having a big day of news, they kind of do that.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, yeah. I don't. What do you think about that timing?
I don't know. The whole timing with everything is thrown off because of COVID, you know. I don't even really know what makes sense and what doesn't make sense anymore. I mean, my initial thought on everything was that with COVID, it doesn't make sense to really launch anything. But I think it's obvious that
stuff has to devices, go on.
So, yeah, the world has to keep spinning. But also, devices are in high demand in general, you know, because we're spending more time on screens than we have even in our hyper screen screenified world with being so distant from each other. So, I mean, I was surprised when I saw that Apple launched the new iPad Pros and such. And you know, obviously Apple's launched opening their retail stores and all that. But now I'm realizing kind of like, first of all, the way COVID is affecting the world is kind of in phases, right? Like China is not really dealing with the outbreak to nearly the extent they were a month or two ago. And so some of the supply side things that were concerns at first are like not even an issue at all. I mean, I'm pretty sure most of the factories in China and India are all, I'm not sure about India, but pretty sure all the factories in China are all back to business.
Yes.
Just with precautions in place. And so the supply side things is not really a problem. It doesn't seem like, besides maybe delaying things by a month or a couple of weeks. It seems like that's going to be the case with a lot of the flagship devices later this year. Maybe the Pixel 5 will be in that category, just like the, you know, the iPhone's rumored to be, maybe delayed a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I think we'll see the 4A sooner rather than later. I liked Dieter's tweet of where is it? You know, like you said, this was supposed to be I/O week, and so this was supposed to be the launch time frame. What do you think about suggestions that it would launch at the developer thing for Android 11? Like,
it's the messaging is just so weird. You're announcing your new phone with the old quote unquote OS,
right?
And it's, I don't know, what I'm seeing on the socials is that people, that at least one person I saw was confused into thinking that the 4A would end up launching with Android 11, and they're worried about the stability issues. So the messaging's unclear. It's this close integration between the Android teams and the Pixel teams that we kind of haven't really seen in the past.
Yeah.
So
I don't think that we'll see it launch at that on Android 11 or not. Yeah.
Yeah, Android. The beta launch, though.
Right.
But in the grand scheme of things, Apple really upstaged them by several weeks in terms of them announcing the SE and getting so much press on day one about everybody was making the Pixel 4a comparison. The minute the SE was announced, and that honestly, Google should have launched it before. They should have gotten ahead of that cycle.
They should launch it tomorrow. Like
they should launch it tomorrow.
They should want it to be compared side by side with the iPhone SE as much as possible.
Yeah, before people make their choice and buy the phone.
But also there's so much free press that they can gain by being associated with an Apple product of any kind.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, there are so many people who would not even be talking about the 4A at all if it weren't for the iPhone SE. I mean, I think about the 9 to 5 Mac people, even people are at our own company. There are people that will be thinking about the 4A because of the iPhone SE, and there will be coverage about the 4A over at 9 to 5 Mac. It would not normally be happening, most likely, because the iPhone SE exists. So I think, I don't know, some could argue that's maybe riding on coattails a little bit, but who cares?
Yeah. A mention in the press is a mention in the press. People talking about it is people talking about it. It helps. It works. And it helps people stave off their purchases.
Right. So... yeah, that's Pixel 4a, and it's coming probably in a week or two or three. I don't think it's coming at that beta launch event. That just doesn't make sense messaging wise to me. Mute yourself.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about Pixel 5, which is the next phone that's coming this later this year, almost certainly. And we're hearing some very initial little rumor tidbits about it. We don't know that much. We kind of have an idea of what the processor is going to be. We have an idea that it'll probably be priced lower than the mainstream Pixel phones have been priced up to this point. It's obviously going to, just like every other Pixel phone, going to focus on camera and such. But now we're kind of hearing from one of our tipsters that the Pixel 5 is kind of going to try to go back to basics. I think this is just initial rumors. Obviously, we kind of have different tiers of confidence in our reports. Anything that we feel extremely confident about, we just report on 9to5 Google. And then there's kind of other things that we kind of put under the category of rumor. And then there's things that are dubious, kind of hearsay, that we throw in this podcast, including Pixel 4a pricing and such. And that's just rumors we're hearing from people that we can't confirm or don't have the time to confirm or don't want to put the effort in to confirm. But yeah, initial thoughts on the Pixel 5a, or initial rumors on the Pixel 5a. We've heard that Google's stripping just like the extras that Google launched with the 4a. And to us, that would probably include Soli. I mean, especially if the Pixel 5 is going to be in that closer to being mid-range price and not the top end $899 price range. You know, I think it makes sense that some of these frills would go away. I am honestly, I could not be more disappointed with Soli. I'm the guy who hyped up Soli for 5 years and followed every minor development from the day it was announced at Google I/O 2015 during the ATAP press conference. Soli and Jacquard, I've been kind of advocates of. Because Soli is such a promising technology, and some of the things that were demoed are so promising, and none of that has come to fruition. And that includes the first major product that actually shipped with Soli. And so I don't know about you. Do you find the hands-free controls of Soli useful at all? Does anyone find them useful at all? Do you use them? What are your thoughts?
I barely use them anymore. I think if the feature set was as rich as it was at launch, if it was even richer, if it had provided more utility, I think more people would have adopted it. But but the example I'm going to point to is playing play and pause on music by like tapping it, by virtually tapping in the air. That should have launched on day one. But instead, Google took the feature drop approach, wherein they add software features based on hardware functionality over time in 3-month increments. And I think that they missed the opportunity to make the complete case for why Soli exists on day one. To me, my usage, there are specific use cases where I use it on a frequent basis, but it's not intuitive. I just don't think about using it all the time.
Yeah, there's kind of a very high threshold for something like that to become a core part of your daily use of a phone. And that threshold has not been passed. And some of those things were imagined when Soli was first announced. You know, if you go back and watch the original, you know, demo videos, kind of showed some really cool ideas of being able to, you know, slide your fingers on themselves to, you know, have very fine tuned control of different interfaces and apps and such. And it just seems like that was too ambitious for the smartphone at this time. And it seems like that also may have been limited by the physical size limitations of the radar sensor. Mm-hmm. We don't really know, but it just is not in its current state. It's just not, it's not going to fundamentally change the way we use our phones. And no. I think that was what Google was hoping for. And I don't think that anything they did with the Pixel 4a the 4 really shows any promise that if they were to continue iterating, like, I'm not sitting here looking at what they did with the Pixel 4 and thinking like, man, if they just keep working on it, they just continue iterating, then they could do something great. And I felt that way about, you know, the Pixel Slate, for example. Like, if Google really focused on developing its tablet hardware and gave it 5 years, then maybe in 5 years they would have something that would compete. But, you know, it feels like it's going to go the same way as the Pixel Slate, which is, you know, it was a worthwhile effort. And not worthwhile to continue developing. And And that's unfortunate and sad. And it seems like Jacquard is going to go that way too. I hate to say it, but Jacquard has not picked up any traction, in anything, in anything other than being
a yeah.
nerdy gadget.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Honestly, in a way, it's what if you put the experimental features on a cheap phone, and instead of making the experimental features a premium, you democratize it. Price at the end of the day is what rules everything. If it's cheap enough, people will get into their hands. They'll like the cool features a new phone has. And I don't know.
The thing is, though, with every single experiment, and I guess you could call it moonshot. I mean, ATAP is a little mini moonshots, right? Inside Google. Mm-hmm. I think with every single moonshot, the hope is that the years of paying Ivan Puparev and his whole team to develop this, the hope is that there's eventually going to be some financial benefit. And that's why Google pushes so hard to push these into something that might bring it some kind of direct or indirect profit, I guess. It just seems like the Pixel 4 just didn't prove that would ever be the case with this. Although it's cool technology, and I really hope and I'm optimistic that there will be some kind of implementation of it in the future. And I will note that it did make face unlock on the Pixel 4 moderately better.
Yes, it did.
So that's that. But is it worth having an extra chip inside? And I think that's the cost benefit of that. And I think the answer is probably going to turn out to be no on that. So if I were to guess right now, I would guess that the Pixel 5 is not going to have a Soli sensor. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, what else? Do you think it's going to revert? I mean, if it's going to be mid-range, you know, let's compare it to what we know is happening with the Pixel 4a. Obviously, the Pixel 4a is, in 2020 terms, low mid-range, even at 349. You know, it used to be that 349 was mid-range. Now it's kind of like that's the bottom of the barrel. With phones launching at 1200 and up, you know, it's like if the Pixel 5 is $700, what other things will they drop? Are they going to drop face-based stuff completely? Are they going to go with a hole punch on the front and go back to fingerprints? I don't know. If the Pixel 5 is a return to the basics, it feels like a return to the Nexus. Like, really, it feels like the Pixel 5 will be the spiritual successor to the Nexus 6P.
Nexus 6P, I don't know. I would actually say, well, the original Nexus 5, the second Nexus 5, the 5X was quite bad, actually. But yeah, it's an interesting thought. But at the same time, don't you feel like that's what the first three generations of Pixel phones were? They were, of course, they were expensive, but they tried to deliver on, they tried to make a basic phone with...
I don't know. I mean, I feel like the way that the original Pixel was priced, which was right in line with the iPhone, showed that, I don't know, I felt like the Pixel line has been Google's attempt, both from a marketing perspective. I mean, there's a reason why they changed the name from Nexus to Pixel, because it represented a change, a shift in tone, and it represented a shift. I mean, what didn't this information report this week just show that Rick... his original hope was that the Pixel would be a substantial third pole, I guess, competitor to the iPhone and the Samsung Galaxy line. You know, like the hope was that this would legitimize Google's hardware efforts and really bring Google into the mainstream in smartphone hardware and other hardware. And I really feel like that's what the original Pixel represented. While the Nexus, even the late ones, the 6, 6P, 5X, etc., they still had that implied admission that this was not Google trying to take on the world. They were admitting that this is a good phone, a basic phone that meets all of the needs of your average Android tech enthusiast. Mm-hmm. And it feels to me like, you know, with decisions like the Pixel 4, ditching the fingerprint sensor, for example, that was extremely unpopular among what would be called the Nexus crowd, right? It was not a controversy at all for people that might be interested in coming over to the Pixel from an iPhone, because the iPhone did that a couple years ago. And so it wasn't even a question. And so to me, if the Pixel 5 regresses to maybe simplifying things and going back to appealing to that core audience, it feels like a return to the roots. And it feels like, I feel like with, if that happens, with a return to the roots will also come an admission of defeat, because you can't, you know, like the original Pixel genuinely did want to compete head to head with the iPhone and the Galaxy. Sure. And the Pixel 5 simply won't. It will be lower. I mean, I don't know, maybe in today's terms it does, but it's not the same. Like, now Apple's kind of iPhone 11 or iPhone 12, which is their entry level phone, yeah, that's the same price as where the Pixel 5 would be, but it's an admission of defeat in terms of going against the primary flagship phone. And maybe it's kind of been a slow fade away from that ambition ever since the original Pixel, because clearly last year, even, you know, Pixel 4 was more of an iPhone 11 competitor than it was an iPhone 11 Pro Max competitor. So, I don't know. Lots of mixed thoughts. I'll have to stew a little bit, hopefully have something more put together by next week. But that's where I stand on Pixel 5. It feels like it's going to be very, I bet you, if I were to bet today, the Pixel 5 is going to be immensely popular amongst people who read 9to5google.com. Like, it's going to be the most popular Pixel to date amongst our readership, amongst people who read 9to5google and people who read Android Police. But at the same time, I think it's going to be kind of an admission of defeat in terms of Rick just didn't make it. Like, the five year ambition for Google to be taken seriously in smartphone hardware, it just didn't pan out. And so, I don't know. Where do you see there being any alternative to that? Do you have a alternative story here other than that, given what we know about the Pixel 5? What do you think?
If the primary goal is to sell more phones, is if it's to get their devices in more people's hands, it's the cost is the first thing to cut. It goes against this idea of Pixel as a Pixel stays premium, or whatever that quote was before. It really does. And as we've seen with the Pixel 3a and soon the Pixel 4a, their priorities have changed. It's if they want to justify the existence of Google hardware, they need to start getting into more people's hands. And at the end of the day, this is how you do it. You price it to be affordable, and who knows, maybe this starts a new trend in smartphones of that being enough for people.
Yeah, my big optimistic question in the long run is Google going to, I mean, they've been burning money. They've been seriously burning money since they started the Pixel. And are they going to tone that down? And with the current state of the economy and in COVID and such, I feel like the likelihood that the tone it down option plays out is higher than it would have been. Or are they going to stay steady and just keep trucking? Are we going to see Pixel 6, 7, 8, and they're just going to keep pumping out iterations every year? Or are they going to pour even more gas on the fire or more money in the furnace and try to build something that truly goes head to head with the premium iPhones and the premium Galaxy phones? Optimistic me, who's a fan of Google and fan of their hardware division and fan of the Pixel, I really hope they do build something expensive and nice that maybe doesn't sell super high volumes, but demonstrates what could be some significant prowess in hardware. And obviously that investment is going to pay off in the long run, regardless if Google keeps making any kind of hardware. But I feel like realistic me thinks that this story of the Pixel phone, in terms of it being Google's attempt to be an alternative to the iPhone taken seriously, I think those days might be limited. But I've tried to not be pessimistic. So that's our show, I think. I think we're going to wrap it there. Sorry to end on such a somber and depressing tone. I guess going back to the positive, the Pixel 4a looks to be very promising and looks like it's going to be a really great phone for a lot of people. And it's going to be $349 and it's probably going to launch at 128 gigs at that price. So that's going to be a super great value. Can't wait to write about it. Can't wait to get our hands on it. And cannot wait to tell everyone what we think about it in comparison to, well, it's easily going to destroy everything else in the middle range of the Android market. But it'll be interesting to compare it with the iPhone SE. So yeah, I think we're going to call the show there and we'll see you next week. You can tune in Alphabet Scoop here every week. We record this podcast every single week. We've been recording on Thursdays lately, and you can find us on all your favorite podcasting platforms such as iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, Google Play. I think I'm going to stop saying that. That's going to be the last time. This is it. This is your last chance to hear me say Google Play Music on the show outro. And you can also listen directly over at 95google.com and our RSS feed. And thank you so much for watching. We really appreciate you tuning in. And we'll see you next week. Thanks for joining, Abner.
Bye.